At 6:20, this is KERA News. I'm Justin Martin. Fort Worth Mayor Betsy Price will be at the White House Monday when President Donald Trump unveils his $1.5 trillion infrastructure plan. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram reports Price's office believes she may have been the only Texas mayor to get an invitation. Studies have shown a high rate of suicide in the veterinary community. In a recent CDC survey, one of every six vet school grads said they'd consider taking their own life. The WNYC podcast series Death, Sex, and Money have been looking into this when producers learned a veterinarian and two veterinary technicians in Dallas killed themselves in separate incidents within weeks of each other. KERA's Sam Baker spoke with podcast host Anna Sale about what she learned in Dallas.
You know, we went to a 24-hour emergency hospital, so there's pets to deal with at every hour. And one thing we heard from a veterinary social worker is it creates this environment where if you're a vet tech who has to administer euthanasia, you've got to go right to the next pet patient, and not a lot of time to reflect and to process what you're doing. And another thing this social worker said to us is if you think about it, veterinarians are not just healthcare providers, they're also funeral directors. And so it's not just treating these patients, it's also then following them through the end-of-life process and into death and dealing with that very up close.
This was Sandra Breckenridge. That was a social worker you spoke with. Which I found interesting in and of itself that there is a social worker in a veterinary hospital.
Veterinary social work has been around for decades. She traditionally has focused her attentions on the pet owners. But because of this acknowledgement of the work stresses, she's focused on the workers to try to make sure that they are taking care of themselves and know about resources if they need help.
Veterinarians and veterinary technicians develop a comfort with death, a lesser degree of death anxiety than other professionals.
Does that mean you fear death less? Does it mean it?
Yes.
Is that at all correlated with when you're stressed and need to escape, that suicidal ideation is something that you go to?
I think it contributes.
Another problem is the expectation of clients that people treat their animals like children. I think you talked with vet tech Kelly Bishop, who told you that leads to uncomfortable conversations about treatment costs.
I kind of want to protect the client here, but I also want what's best for the dog or the cat. But the doctor's going to want to run these tests, but the owner can't afford it. How can I make the best of both worlds happen?
That's a really difficult conversation because as a pet owner, you have to decide, are you going to spend the money to help your pet or are you going to say, I can't afford it? That can cause resentment. That can cause anger. And the staff at the veterinary hospital is often the front line for that.
No one's sure whether to call three suicides in 1 year in the veterinary community a crisis, but it has spurred action.
It did spur a conversation about how workers in the veterinary field can talk more directly about the mental health stresses that they face and also how to talk directly about it and not ignore it because of stigma. After this episode came out, we've heard from some of the people who are in it that they're hopeful that it will also create an awareness among pet owners who bring their animals to these clinics and hospitals about what this staff is going through and what their lives are like, because it's kind of hidden from the general public. You don't think about it, about what the realities are. So what happened in Dallas last year was very sad, and it shook the veterinary community into saying, what can we do to have more honest and direct conversations about the mental health of the people that we work with and to create more awareness about what happens in veterinary medicine?
You often described the veterinary community in the podcast as tight-knit. Why wasn't there support on this level before now?
These are very busy people who are trying to do the best they can to run businesses, to take care of animals, and to keep things going. So figuring out how to pause and do mental health check-ins and how to support each other when you're just trying to do the work of providing veterinary medicine, you know, it's not the top priority. So I think that this did shift that into saying, like, we've got to figure out ways to better integrate and to train ourselves how to support each other while we're doing this work. Because I think there is a growing acknowledgement that the particular combination of factors in veterinary medicine today are quite stressful. I think veterinary medicine as a whole, not just in Dallas, is trying to figure out ways to train and better support people who work in this field.
Anna Sale, thank you for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
Anna Sale is host of the podcast series Death, Sex, and Money. The Dallas Morning News co-reported the piece. The story will appear in Sunday's paper. We have a link to the podcast at KEINews.org. To make the Laramie Project, Moises Kaufman and his theater company interviewed hundreds of people about the murder of gay college student Matthew Shepard. The play has become one of the most performed pieces of contemporary theater. Now, Kaufman is artist in residence at the University of North Texas. In our State of the Arts conversation, Art Seeks Hadi Mawagdi talks with the playwright about his unique approach to theater.
So, Moises, you created a theatrical method known as moment work. Can I get you to briefly describe the technique?
There are several ways in which plays are created. The most common way is that a playwright goes into a room, writes a play, and then gives it to the director, and the director and actor stage the play, right? And, you know, moment work in particular says that if we come into the rehearsal room with some lights, with some sounds, with some sets, that we can begin to create theatrical narratives. That doesn't mean that we're getting rid of the playwright. On the contrary, we're asking the playwright to come with us as we create. But moment work is a way of devising theater using all of the elements of the stage in the creation of narrative.
And that means chairs on the stage could become obstacles, or the lights can become sort of a character that maybe we don't hear from, but is interpreting something. Is that right?
Yes, it means also that, you know, that you begin to really craft narratives that are much more theatrical in spirit. There's still characters, there's still dramatic action. That's why this idea of devising work has been having such popularity amongst students and theater makers, because it's opening the door. It's saying, okay, we can get in a room and begin to create stories theatrically.
Most people will probably know you from the Laramie Project, you know, the true story of Matthew Shepard. But you're here in North Texas to develop a play with UNT students about a surrealist writer named Jorge Luis Borges. Does moment work translate easily from fact to fiction?
Definitely, because it doesn't matter what work you are devising. Sometimes the theatrical narratives can start from a real-life event. Sometimes can start from a short novel. Sometimes can they start from a short story, like in this case, of Jorge Luis Borges. So yeah, it adapts to whatever it is, because it's not about the source material, it's about what you do with the source material.
Where are you mining material for this story?
We started with one of his short stories that we fell in love with called The Circular Ruins, but we've also been looking at a lot of his other work, his poetry, his essays. The man was a genius, and so there's a lot of material to draw from.
What is it about him that fascinates you?
He finds a ways of telling stories that go to the heart of who we are as human beings, of how we live in the world, of what we believe, and how our system of beliefs comes about. A lot of people call him the Latin American Kafka, because he also shares some of Kafka's fascinations with dream and with repetition and with the unknown.
Well, you've been in North Texas for almost 2 full weeks now, and you've been working with the students. How have they reacted to the technique?
Oh, they've been wonderful. The students here have been really eager and hungry and curious. It's interesting. Sometimes you go to certain universities that perhaps are in more, you know, in bigger cities, and the students there are a little more jaded. Here I find that the students are very hungry, very curious, very open. It's been a delight.
You were raised by an Orthodox Jewish family, the son of a Holocaust survivor, and in a deeply Roman Catholic country in Venezuela. And I think I read that you said you felt very isolated, and I wonder how theater helped you with that, or if it did at all.
Meryl Streep spoke about this recently, that she said that she didn't fit in, and so that she started looking at people around her and imitating them, because she knew that if she could imitate them well enough, they would accept her. And that some of her best performances of her career were in high school, right, when she was trying to be other people. I think for me, because I realized early on that I was gay, and I was inside an Orthodox Jewish community, inside of a Catholic and very machista country, I was an outsider once removed or twice removed. That sense of being an outsider gives you an incredibly accurate perspective of social mores, of other people's behaviors. You become a great observer of social interaction in order to survive. And I think that what we do in the theater is we recreate social interactions. And so I think that's why there's a connection there.
Are we going to get to see this play in the spring?
I think we'll show about 15 or 20 minutes of something. I mean, it's not going to be a full play. It's going to be a sketch or something, but it'll let you see what we were playing with, what we were thinking about.
Well, Moises, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Temperatures should be in the 50s after sunrise tomorrow, but it'll drop to about 30 degrees later in the day throughout much of North Texas. Tomorrow night, the National Weather Service expects an approaching disturbance from the west will combine with an Arctic cold front, leading to the possibility a freezing drizzle and rain. It's 6:30. This is KERA News.